Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. Welcome to Face to Face and another beautiful morning here in Toronto at the Verity Club. I'm sitting here with my today's guest, Nina Spencer. Thanks for joining us, Nina.
My pleasure.
That's Nina Spencer. Let's get the plug in nice and early. NinaSpencer.com, NinaSpencer.com. Getting passion out of your profession, how to keep loving your living, come what may. That's the subtitle of her book, Getting Passion Out of Your Profession. Book that came out a couple of years ago, I believe, sold fairly well. Mm-hmm. And if you're not on board yet, Nina is a motivational speaker. She's a teacher, and from what I can tell, just a really wonderful person. So we're gonna get into a couple things in just a minute. But let me just read you a couple of the chapter titles here. Practice positive thinking, positive word choice, and the sound of it all. Project professional self-worth. Protect sense of humor. A little bit of alliteration going on here. Play with perspective. Profess purpose. Preserve energy and enthusiasm. Promise to persevere. Perpetuate relationships. And the last chapter, which is Class Starts Now. Pretty interesting, actually, Nina, that the class starts at the end of the book. So again, thanks for joining us. You know, I've done a little bit of this type of speaking myself over the years, certainly heard lots, you know, working with different corporations and so on. I've always kind of wondered what motivates the motivator. What is it that's driving you? You know, is it Dale Carnegie and How to Win Friends and Influence People? Was that like the first thing that sort of, you know, was dropped on your doorstep, or was it an experience or a collection?
Well, he's definitely one of the granddaddies of them all, but I confess I've never read.
You've never read Dale Carnegie?
I've never, shame on you, smack
that's
me.
Right, that's right.
But definitely, I know that I have him to thank historically,
sure, yeah,
for the rise of the whole profession,
yeah,
of inspirational,
yeah. Greatest salesman in the world. Do you remember that one?
Og Mandino,
right? Yes.
Zig Ziglar, used to say something about people say that motivational speaking doesn't work because it wears off, and his response was, but so does a bath. That's why you have to have one regularly.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So,
that's,
know,
really good.
Motivational speaking or inspirational speaking as a formulaic part of a professional development plan inside an organization or an association, it's part. I think that's key.
Yep.
It's part of a larger strategy or program for buoying people up and keeping them energized and enthused.
So you actually would say almost, I just went through a strategic planning process with an organization, and you would almost argue that it's worth slotting that in, those types of events, or we're going to bring in people to talk about X, Y, and Z over the next 3 to 5 years in our plan.
And recurringly.
Yeah,
perhaps
sure.
Not once a month, but some organizations do have lunch and learns and they bring in different people.
Yes, yeah.
Once a month.
Yeah.
But definitely episodically and recurringly, not even just for what Zig Ziglar said.
Right.
But,
which is great, by the way, because it's kind of true. There's so many things we need to be reminded
sure.
of.
Sure. You know? And I often think of it like a good movie that you have seen. Think of a movie that you've seen more than once.
I'm quite a
movie file, right? And even though you've seen it 3 times, 4 times, more times than you can count, if you come across it by accident on television, don't you just have to sit down and watch it to its conclusion?
Yes, it's true.
Right?
Commercials and all.
Yeah.
And it's sitting on your shelf.
And you could have watched the whole
thing.
You
could have popped the DVD in, and it's just, yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah.
So I think folding in motivational exposure to motivational speaking or inspirational speaking or keynote speakers who are offering education for clients as something like that. Even if you've heard this message before, you haven't heard it necessarily from this speaker on this day.
Over coffee, you had mentioned that, you know, it sounded to me like you mentioned that one of the threads through, you know, as you look back at all the different jobs you had, including your DQ job, which I want to hear more
about.
Yes, okay. Dollar an hour, right?
A dollar an hour.
But it sounded to me like the thread was teaching, which I think is really interesting, because mm-hmm. I think sometimes, at least my experience has been, oh, motivational speaker. There's sort of a pejorative edge.
Sure. Right? And sometimes I do choose to use another kind of word.
Yeah.
Because there is.
Teacher makes sense, right?
Well, we're keynote speakers in the profession. We hit the keynote of a particular conference. And conferences are, you know, looking for the best within, leading the way, navigating through change. Theme titles that are usually attached to annual conferences, whether they're internal staff conferences or association conferences. So we focus on folding in good, practical skills. I'll speak just for myself. I make sure to fold in good, practical skills that can be applied the very next day at work and hopefully in private life as well. So they straddle the two realms of,
right.
of our world. It must be entertaining. If it's at an annual conference, in my opinion, there should be a fair amount of entertainment that's folded in or marbled in. But if it's just entertainment, it's too lightweight, it's too fluff and stuff, if you will.
Yep, yep.
So I can't help but want to make sure that it's also practical. And that is some of my background as well. I spent many years inside organizational development. In the olden days, they called it training and development or corporate training and development. So it's in my blood, if you
right.
will,
sure.
that I secretly, or perhaps not so secretly, want to make sure that anything that comes out of my mouth on the platform within 60 minutes also has some good, solid content and educational value.
Right.
But you're right about just getting back to your observation about there's a theme of teaching. I am not a teacher. I'm not a BED.
Right.
My background is in psychology. My degree is in psychology. But when I look back over all the years from the time I was 14, we talked about the Dairy Queen being my first job. That was my only non-teaching job, the Dairy Queen. After that, I went on to be a camp counselor with the YMCA. It's fun to stay there. Figure skating. I was a figure skater, a serious figure skater through my teen years and early 20s. So I turned professional and I taught figure skating. Mm. Then I left figure skating and went into corporate working and went into HR and training and development. So I look back and I see that I've always been teaching and instructing enthusiastically thing or another.
What I found interesting about when you were chatting about the DQ job,
yes.
and by the way, if there was anywhere I could go tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday night, it would be Dairy Queen. I'm a big fan. And I know it's fake ice cream, but...
it's not fake ice cream.
Oh, I thought it was fake
it's
ice cream.
It's 2% milk. Put it in there. Unless they've changed the formula over
I think
the years.
They put a little bit of crack cocaine in there as well, because it's awfully good and kind of addictive.
Yes.
What's interesting, you know, even though you said that the EQ job maybe not, you know, really teaching, what you focused on, though, was a teachable moment, because you said to me, we used to get to eat yes. our mistakes.
Yes.
I mean, if that's not a metaphor for going on to do the work that you've done, I don't know what is.
Well, yes, we did. We got to eat our mistakes because they wanted that symbolic, that trademark mm-hmm. curlicue on the top.
Which is
fabulous,
by the way.
You know, there's a little bit of a technique to learning that.
There is, yes.
And if then you have to make the mounds go a certain way with the machine.
That's right.
You
know, it's quite perfect,
so we would make mistakes on purpose. Oops, that's a mistake. Guess I got to eat it.
Funny.
Stick it in the freezer for later.
Funny. And so what you end up with is an awful lot of overweight young people working at Dairy Queen.
No wonder I could only do that job for right. 1 month.
Now, from a management perspective, though, how many mistakes were you allowed, you know, before
nobody
they
really counted, but they did notice
funny.
That the ice cream was going down a fair amount and it didn't match what was in the till.
That's
so,
funny.
We were blamed for making our blizzards and our milkshakes too thick.
Thin
those things out,
thin them out, right? Profits being eaten up, literally. So who is a guru for you? I mean, is it a Ziegler? Is it a Norman Vincent Peale? Is it somebody like, or is it a psychologist? Is it somebody, you know, if you had to go back and say, here's a foundational thinker, a writer, a woman, somebody who really does inspire me, motivates me to not only to get out of bed in the morning, but to really make a difference.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, that's a tough question. It's kind of like saying, what's your favorite movie? What's your favorite book?
Well, I can, you know? I can share with you who were my influences in my earlier days. For example, I just adored Tom Peters. I did. Tom Peters in Search of Excellence, especially in the 1990s. And he did, in my opinion, so many platform skills, and I'm putting this in air quotes for you, wrong.
Right.
He did a lot. He paced and yelled, and there was a lot of passionate, frenetic energy. And I'm sure that there are some organizations out there that teach platform skills that would say, don't do this.
Yes.
But it worked for him because he was so authentic. Do you know, have you ever
seen Yeah, I have not. Talk? No, not. I know the book, but yeah.
So I just remember, very inspired by the fact that he didn't necessarily follow the rules, if
right.
you will, but he definitely came from the heart. Then I think of Margaret Wheatley, who has an entirely different presentation style. It's very serene. She stays place in one place, quiet voice. Hmm. You wouldn't think that would necessarily work mm-hmm. for a mm-hmm. thousand people.
Yeah, right? sure.
But yet it does. So it's been nice to take a bit of a composite. I think I'm thinking American Canadian in terms
yeah, it could
of the stress.
Be. Yes, yeah.
But of this speaker style, this that speaker style, that person's message, and so on. I was influenced in early days by Peter Senge too, by the Fifth Discipline and the whole focus on systems thinking. Leadership books like Stephen Covey. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. When I was up and coming, these were the people that were big. William Bridges, Job Shift.
And are you?
I'm really having to dig through the archives
of my
head right now.
And do you read any of these folks today, or are you really trying to distill kind of your own experiences? And your
oh
own
no,
thinking?
I'm staying on top of all kinds of. Colleagues' work and messages.
Right
now I'm reading Quiet, which is by Susan Cain. And that's, if I can remember the subtitle, about how to be an introvert in a world that won't stop talking or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Fascinating book. And good for me to get.
Right.
To understand, because I perceive myself as an extrovert.
Right.
But it's important, I believe, for speakers to recognize that there are all kinds of people in the audiences. If you're talking about the Myers-Briggs formula of how you identify different people, everybody is represented in an audience. And if I want to inspire as many people as possible and ultimately have all the people stay with me to the very end, it would behoove me to make sure that I appreciate and understand that there are different ways of experiencing my message. And that if I'm only playing to the extroverts, then I'm going to lose some of the people. So Susan's work is very interesting to me. She doesn't care to present, I understand, but she does because she knows that's part of the deal when you have a book.
Right.
But she's great.
How do you balance the entertainment with substance?
That's a great question. And there's a little joke. I don't even really know if it's true, but I have a hunch it might be. There's a theory that says the further southwest you go on the continent of North America, the more entertainment, the lighter on content. The further northeast you go, higher on content, lower on entertainment.
Interesting. I've never heard that before. A geographic
distinction. So west versus east and north versus south. But I believe that you better make sure that it includes both. I'm a speaking coach as well as doing this for my own services. and it's part of my coaching advice that you need to have moments where it's where you lighten up, where you can inspire the audience to audibly laugh, not just have a little smile inside, but write out LOL, out loud laugh. Get them involved, participation. Sometimes even standing up. My keynotes always include participants getting up out of their seats.
Well, if people are sitting for an hour, I think that's a pretty smart performance approach and stage technique, you know, theatrical technique, frankly. Yeah, it's hard to sit for that long.
But even as a PS to the question, all the time, I'm tweaking and rearranging on the fly. I have a clear understanding of what it is that I'm going to do that has a beginning and a middle and an end. But based on the feel of the audience, based on the political atmosphere that I have been privy to before I start, I tweak my presentation, I change it. Do I really think this audience will go for this, or will they be adverse to this? Do I dare to go out on the skinny branches and appeal to them to participate in this exercise or so on? So to me, that's answering your question in terms of how do I strike that balance between content and humor. Some of it is my intuition.
Yeah. Well, some of it must come down just intuition, that experience of working for many different people in many different places, cultures. You've got a lot of things going on when you walk out onto a stage. Temperature of the room can affect it.
Absolutely.
Did people eat anything? Are they coming back from lunch? You know, all
how
those
rotten
things.
Was the weather out? How hard was it to get to the location that day?
Makes a difference.
And, you know, the economy, the politics of the day can sometimes.
Sure.
Once, a long time ago, I think it was even still in the 1990s, 99 or whatever, I didn't know back then to ask the question, you know, what's politically hot right now in your organization? Is there anything I should know before I begin? And as the president of the company introduced me, he also, just beforehand, told them bad news.
Great.
That was going to impact their work and probably cause some percentage of people to lose their job the following year. And this was in
nice
November.
Intro.
And now, Nina Spencer,
positive thinking. That's right.
Talk about feeling ambushed.
Yeah.
And it was all I could do to keep yanking it out of my hat.
And did you ultimately, though, end up speaking to the truth in that situation? Like, did you find yourself ever referring back to, wow, that was crummy news, I'm really sorry about that, in some way?
Yes.
You didn't gloss over it with a smile?
No.
Yeah.
But still, people weren't engaged.
Yeah, no, how could
they were
be?
Distracted, they were disrupted, and it was nothing personal. Yet, show me a speaker, even the most seasoned of speakers, who wouldn't at least somewhat be distracted and pulled off their game a little bit, knowing that as their lips are moving.
Right?
That these people, their heart isn't in being there now.
Right. Leads me to another interesting, I think, question. Do you find yourself taking risks a lot on stage? Do you find yourself pulling something out that wasn't in your plan?
Sure, sometimes.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but yes, I will go with it. And I think that not only is a hallmark of a fine speaker, it's also a hallmark of a fine workshop facilitator, perhaps even more so than a speaker.
Right.
Because a speaker is essentially doing a one-way communication, essentially. I mean, they may be involved, but with workshop facilitation, somebody will ask a question and it's not part of the workshop lesson plan. But we need to go there. So we run with it. And then after a few minutes of conversation, you pull it back. So yes, it's fun to do that.
A lot of speakers I've heard, and I've certainly used it. I teach at Humber College in Toronto, 80 students a year. And, you know, you'll often find yourself, I do 2.5 hour classes and it's not all lecture. I mean, I'm very dialogical and try to engage the students and so on. But often, you know, I'll find myself that cliche. Well, if there's one thing I want you to take away today, this is it. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself saying that? Do you feel that in a talk like this that, you know, I don't know what the stats are about people, what they retain with visuals versus verbal, et cetera. I'm sure you do. Mm-hmm. But do you find yourself hoping or saying, wow, you know, as long as the group today takes away one key sure. item, I've done my job.
Absolutely.
Well.
And yeah. I really believe it, even though you're right. I agree that there's a bit of a cliche.
There is a bit of a cliche tone, isn't there?
But, you know, maybe that's what makes me the Pollyanna or whatever. But I do believe if I put my head on my pillow on any given day and I learned one new thing that I didn't know
yeah.
today,
yeah.
even if it's a new word, yes. I've just learned antebellum. I never knew antebellum before. So it's kind of fun to yeah. think there's something new in my day. It's not a carbon copy of yesterday.
I think it's amazing. And I've got a 5 and a 7-year-old, Victoria and Spencer, and they are teaching me all kinds of things. And
there you are.
I keep this wonderful diary. Actually, I'm on my second book, several hundred pages of thoughts and notes and questions that my kids have either asked or things that we've done together. So yeah, you're right. I'm with you. This it's a kind of a... fascination with wonder, in a way, I think. For me, anyway,
it comes back to stay in wonder.
To stay again, in
another,
wonder.
That sounds like another cliche. Oh,
it
stay
does.
In wonder.
Yeah.
Kumbaya.
Yeah. But yeah. Well, there is a kumbaya edge to it, but you know what? The Ziegler commented, but it's like taking a bath. You got to mm-hmm. be reminded of mm-hmm. that because it's staring you in the face. Mm-hmm. And it's that Edgar Allan, I mean, I bring it up all the time, Edgar Allan Poe's purloined letter. He mm-hmm. hung it right in front of everyone so that they wouldn't see it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, I think it's kind of tragic, even in my own life. I mean, when getting out of bed in the morning, sometimes it's pretty hard to say, wow, what an awesome day this is going to be.
Well, at least you woke up. You say, oh, I woke up. This
That's
is
right.
good.
That's right.
I didn't die in the night. Yeah, I got another day to try again.
So you don't need your audience members to take everything away. It's not like...
No, you know. And just getting back to your comment about, are you happy if they walk away with one thing? I truly believe this, that if you do walk away with one thing from my presentation... and then implement that all the rest of your days, you will see some percentage of improvement or better value in your experience. So I secretly have my favorite. When I do a conference keynote, I share 5 different points. And that takes an hour, pretty much. In my book, there are 9 different chapters, and each one of those 5 points that I talk about in a keynote corresponds to a chapter in the book. So I've cherry-picked my 5 favorite chapters, if you will. But secretly, I have my favorite of those 5. Secretly, I would prefer, I don't know if prefer is the right word, but I would be happy if everybody took away the first of
right,
the 5
right,
ideas.
Right.
Now, if they attach more to the second or the third, fourth, or fifth, that's fine. But I'm very particularly passionate about my first suggestion. You want to know what it is?
I do.
Taking a look at the choice of words we use when we're communicating with one another.
You said earlier, and it might have been while we were offline, but and I wrote it down because I wanted to come back to it. You said words are powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to come back to that mm-hmm. and just maybe that's where you're going.
Well, and we know that. We know that's true. I hate your guts. I hate you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love you.
Yes.
It's just words. But you know that there's a lot of stuff behind those words.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of an extreme example. But when we are in the workplace, in a very, very subtle way, choosing these words instead of those words can yield a different result. And it might not be easy to measure scientifically, but it's an intuitive thing. It's a gut thing that the other person responds to you differently. Thank you for your patience. I really do believe this, and I've watched it work through the years. Oh, I'm finally here. Thanks for your patience with me. Instead of, oh, I'm sorry I'm late. Thanks for waiting. Right? So it just paints the picture of late, waiting. You know, let's move on with what you really are. You're thanking them for their patience. You hope that they had patience. And I'm here now. Instead of, is this a bad time? Is this a good time? To sashay our language into the area where you want it to go. That's not saying it as well as I want. Let me try that again. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. So words set context.
Mm-hmm.
Words can... diffuse.
Mm-hmm.
They can be
instead
inviting.
Instead of saying, you don't understand me or you've misunderstood.
Right.
This is another one of my favorite ones to point out to people who are in corporate settings or dealing with customer service excellence. Oh, no, ma'am. You've misunderstood me. Well, that's pretty blamey You know, there's a there's a chance that if that person is sensitive, they're thinking, well, what do you mean I misunderstood you? Maybe you didn't communicate it.
If
the service provider has a hunch that that's the truth, and it doesn't even need to be with a customer, it can be between colleagues, it can be between a manager and a staff person, a staff member. Instead of saying, you've misunderstood me, put the brain on a 3-second delay, right? Get the brain engaged before your mouth, goes ahead, and say, oh, I need to say that again. Let me put that another way.
Right.
I need to be clearer. So if they misunderstand, then I put the onus on myself that I didn't communicate it clearly enough.
Right. One of President Obama's favorite sayings is, let me be clear.
And if you go, you know what?
If you go back and you watch some of his speeches, he seems to use that phrase.
When you asked me much earlier, who is a person that I admire? I'm not necessarily here talking about political strategies or the economics of it. I guess I'm not that much of an expert on American politics because it's not my country.
Yep.
So I won't address that or speak about that. As an orator, as a presenter, I just love to watch him.
He's very good.
He really is good.
Yeah.
And you know who else just, I know we're a bit organic in our conversation.
That's okay.
Here.
Are you all right? Yeah.
Sometimes if I'm flipping through the television channels and I come across evangelical speakers, I'm riveted to watch their platform skills.
Right. Oh, some of them some of them are really good performers. Some of them are absolutely horrible.
Yes.
But I get infuriated when I watch them. So,
I'm not listening for their words.
Elizabeth, my wife, gets upset with me if I am flicking and I end up, can you believe this guy? You know, and she'll think,
what
do you watch that stuff for?
You're thinking, you're listening to the
words. I'm listening to content, I suppose. Sometimes I'm astounded by the lack of experience with how to set a toupee, but I mean, that's
and sometimes it is for the don'ts.
Yes.
But there's something interesting. Ah, here's something else just in terms of observing others so that I can make my craft better and things that I have done over the years. Watch Seinfeld or watch Just for Laughs, stand-up comics. Watch their rhythm. Watch how they recognize the arc of a laugh.
Sure.
Yeah. And stop cutting it off. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So many speakers do know, myself included, where the laughs are in our material, in our presentations. We know where, generally speaking, we can expect the audience to laugh. But because we're so intent on saying the next comment, or some of us anyway, we don't let the laughter grow and have its full life. And it's not about the speaker feeling flowers thrown at them. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's about letting the audience have the pleasure of that laughter.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Right?
Yeah,
so
no,
it's a moment. It's not a moment of me taking it and pulling the laughter to me.
Oh, you're milking the applause.
Yeah,
you're milking
thank you.
The laughter.
It's about me letting them have that experience, and I stand by until I watch it go down.
It sets a tone too for the rest of it, and it's about those ups and downs. And I think to some degree, I don't know if you'd agree with this as a performer, but I think a lot of performers are uncomfortable with that. That silence on stage where they're not saying anything. I'm boring the audience, even if there is applause going on, even if there is laughter going on. So I think that's a really good point. Circling back, do good leaders choose their words wisely?
Yes.
Or could we even simplify it? Good people choose their words wisely.
Good people, good leaders, because I'm speaking small L as well as capital L, and everyone is a leader.
Right.
You know, we can be a leader in a lineup at the grocery store.
Right. Sure.
Something's out of place and it belongs over there. You can demonstrate your leadership by just putting it back. That's a silly little example, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think what happens for people who've decided to be awake, conscious, with conscious intent and awake with their communication skills, it comes out naturally. They've practiced it so much. It's like knowing their phone number. Although some people are on speed dial now, so they don't know their phone number anymore. It becomes incorporated into just their style. Now, every now and then you'll meet somebody, and I remember these days back a long time ago when I was in my some of my first jobs. Some people were very good with dealing with difficult people, difficult clients, difficult colleagues, whatever. And then somebody, a third person, might come along and say, "Wow, you know, David, you are so good at dealing with them. I always find them a pain in the neck to deal with, but you so artfully, how do you do that?" And then if your answer is, "I don't know, I'm just being myself."
Yeah.
That to me is having skills that, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say it's more valuable to know you have these skills and to know and do it on purpose. It doesn't make it inauthentic, just, to not to be able to replicate it any time out is an opportunity missed.
Well, I think it's kind of become humanly habituated in a sense, not like a habit as in a, you know, smoking a cigarette or having your first coffee in the morning, but it's become a part of who you are. You know, you treat others with respect, you look for ways out and so on. And I think you're right about that. I wish more of us could do that. You know, I think a lot of us would be in a much better place, a much more positive place when it came to our marriages and our partners and our businesses and the people we work with and hang out with, because it seems to me that, you know, we sort of acquiesce towards the immediate, well, how can I shut them down? Or,
well, something occurs to me now, even while I'm hearing you say that, it's the 10 second thing, isn't it? And there's all kinds of neuroscience around that now. It's very popular right now. But it's very basic too, counting to 10.
Right.
To allow the higher level brain to kick in rather than the primitive fight or flight brain.
Right.
Because that's what happens when we're annoyed with one another. They say this and it's like...
It becomes a boxing match.
Right. And rather than if there were 10 seconds in between what they say and what you reply, then you might reply differently. And I like to think about that difference. I muse that difference between the word react and respond. Because to me, they're not synonyms. To react is that 1-2-1-2.
Yes, yes.
But to respond is to that person does that thing, says that thing. I contemplate it for split seconds or 10 seconds or whatever, and then I respond. Remember when we were in high school? And we were in science class, and you look under the microscope at the amoeba, and didn't we used to put, I seem to remember putting a little solution of salt or something.
Iodine, I don't remember
that's
what
right,
it was.
Whatever that was. And then you watch it change shape. Totally externally controlled. Yes. Its responses are.
Yes, sure.
And some people are like that. So do we want to be like amoebas?
Right.
You know, or be more in control.
There's a joke there, I think.
So. Yeah, I think there is.
So is that one of your favorite pieces of advice for yourself, would you say? Is that one of the things that you've really put into practice from
Absolutely.
The work that you've done over the past
so
15,
much so
20
that
years?
It shows up in, for example, I know, I'm proud of my daughter's artful choice of words in her communication at work with her friends. She's 27 years old, but she has known this skill since she was in grade 5, grade 6, grade 7, all through her, because just like any child whose mother or father is in a particular profession, they are inclined to know more than the average bear about that profession.
Right.
My father was a de Havilland's man, airplane man. So, you know, ask me about the Lancasters and the mosquitoes and the twin otters. And, I know more than lots of other people. So for her, she knows these things because these are the messages. I guess what I'm saying is I walked my talk.
Right.
As a mother.
Which is pretty important for somebody. I mean, I think that's going to come out in your writing. I think it's going to come out in your blogging and your interviews and in your stage work, which is huge. And probably big part of the reason why you've been as successful as you are, it seems to me. And that's got to be some kind of payoff.
Well, here's an example. I'm just thinking now that here's an example. Like any mother-daughter relationship or whatever, sometimes there can be loggerheads, there can be headbutting. And like any mother-daughter or parent-child, we can go right up to the edge, of point of no return, where it's going to get messy and there's going to be sadness or tears or strain. And because we both know these skills, we both know how to either make a moment of humor about it,
right,
or say, say the right kind of words. You know, what you just said, when you said this, I felt.
Right.
I would have preferred if you'd said it this way. Then I could have what, right? The
right.
desk,
yeah.
That's called the desk formula, the
yeah.
describe, explain, specify consequences.
Right.
So if two people are using those strategies, then you can navigate through some tricky stuff.
Yeah.
And not end up having ugliness that makes people not want to speak to each other for 2 weeks.
I'm a huge fan of The West Wing, and now a huge fan of Aaron Sorkin's new show called The Newsroom on HBO.
Anyway,
okay. Little plug there.
Uh-huh.
But I remember watching The West Wing and thinking lots of wonderful things, like there's no way there's this many smart people in the White House. There's no way, they talk like this and so on. And I would watch some of these, the debates, the arguments that would happen in the Rose, I can't remember the name of the room. Anyway, a particular room, and it'd be an argument. And you'd go, real people just don't argue like that. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be awesome and amazing if it was kind of back and forth like that? And people thought about what they said before they said it.
Well, our egos get in the way,
egos
right?
Egos do get in the way, yeah. Well, and we get hurt so easily, right?
Yes.
I think that has a lot
to
do with
that.
But
that's our responsibility to work on that individually.
Yeah.
It's our responsibility to learn not to be triggered. Or to minimize it
in some way.
You're not
yeah.
going to be a perfect saint about it.
And so here I think is a good question for somebody who so believes in positive thinking, who believes in getting out of bed in the morning with a smile on your face that's mm-hmm. going to change the way you work and so on. I guess I'm getting back to this idea of what is it that makes a difference for you from a, I don't want to say motivational perspective, but I guess from a life perspective, the life lesson. So you choose your words carefully. But what else do you do? I mean, I remember reading a book on Buddhism and they talked about, I believe putting a piece of paper on your, the ceiling of where you slept.
Oh yes, I used to have Paul McCartney on the ceiling when I was a kid.
Yes,
right?
I probably would have had Farrah Fawcett, but my mother wouldn't let me. So.
Yeah, we love my sister and I love doing things like that on the ceiling.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, life is hard. Like Scott Peck said in The Road Less Traveled, opening line, life is difficult, period.
Yes.
And I believe that that book was so popular because of that opening line.
Yes.
How do you keep it going?
Yeah.
To
the fourth of the five strategies that I share, and I never did. I was going to tell you about the first one. Oh, we did. We talked about it.
We did. Yeah. Yeah.
Is shifting perspective. No matter what, how can I see this same situation from a different perspective?
Right.
A
divorce.
That's
loss
right.
of a job.
That's right.
Transfer in a job. You didn't get the promotion you wanted. I mean, there's so many things.
Well, even
right?
when you made that comment about being tired in the morning and about the morning, I said, well, at least you woke up.
That's right. At least you woke up. Yeah.
At least
my dad's
you woke
line,
up.
And I know I've said this in other podcasts, I'm sure as I create a database of listeners, they're going to get sick of my phrases. But my dad used to say things like, well, worse things happen at sea, right?
Yeah,
so
worse
at least,
things happen
at least
at
you
sea.
Woke up in the morning.
And
at
I
least
like
your
that one
beating.
About when next yeah. time that people, I'm in a body. I'm not perfect yet.
Yes,
I'm
that's
not a
right.
saint yet.
Yes,
haven't
yes.
moved on, but I do try to do that a lot. I don't
yeah.
just try. I do
yeah.
do
yeah.
that a
yeah.
lot.
Yeah.
When I get too much into pity city and I'm starting to...
Yep.
build a house there
yeah,
rather than
yeah.
just passing through. I think to myself, well, there's a whole bunch of people in today's obituaries who'd love to trade places
it's
with you,
true.
Nina.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
again, oh, come on, so corny.
It is,
but,
you
yeah,
know what?
Not,
some
not
of
to
stuff,
the people who are going to be in today's obituary, it's not corny.
It's not corny, I know. Some of this stuff does sound corny. I interviewed Mark Kingwell, mm-hmm. a philosopher from the University of Toronto, coming mm-hmm. up in a couple of weeks. the podcast, and mm-hmm. we talked about common sense a little bit, and what the mm-hmm. heck is that?
And it's not so common. That's what Voltaire said.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? And I think some of this stuff that we sometimes just kind of let roll off our back that's corny or cliche, I mean, you know, there are reasons why. Yeah. And there's truth in tradition, it seems to me, you know, and things that have come before and so on. Hey, listen, I'm not sure. We have to talk about Kilimanjaro.
Yes.
And we're almost at the end, believe it or not. But I need to ask you, you know, you talked about implementing one thing. Mm-hmm. So you do believe, and this is kind of my thing, mm-hmm. you do believe in incremental change.
Absolutely.
And you believe that you can teach
10% incremental change. Try not to gobble it all down at once.
Yeah.
Give yourself permission to make a 10% incremental change. Then even like on Kili, you get to that platform, you take a breath, and then you go again. Swahili, say poli poli, slowly, slowly. And that is the advice. I summited in January of 2011.
I mean, that's all about incremental change.
That's all about
step at a time
literal
for the love.
And it really was, if you take the next step and then you stop there and then you take the next step. So you can get all the way to where you're going literally just by taking one step.
Again, we're back to the sort of sounds corny a little bit, but mm-hmm. the truth is that's
it
how
is.
You got there.
Yeah. And if you paused long enough in between each of those steps, it would just be one step.
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, sometimes we get a little bit impatient. We want to hurry up. We want to do many steps at once. And even in my book In Progress right now about Kilimanjaro, I tell the story about one gentleman who became exasperated, not on my team, but on another team, who became exasperated at how poli poli, slowly, slowly, they were going, and therefore kind of scampered ahead. He didn't end up summoning.
Wow.
Because
so he sprinted.
It's not about your stamina or the fact that you can go fast. It's about the fact that perhaps you should not go fast, even
right.
if you can go fast.
Right.
Because there are factors to consider. Now, it's metaphoric. It's not altitude at work. But, you know, metaphorically, there are some altitude things
sure.
to be watchful
sure.
of at
sure.
work. And the reason why you go poli-poli is so that you can acclimatize, so that the edema, the threat of edema and the swelling of the brain and of your organs does not happen. The slower you go, higher the probability of summiting.
How long did it take?
7 days.
7 days. And
seven
that was from like
summit.
First step to last step?
No, 9 days from first step to last step.
Okay.
7 days to summit, 2 days to descend.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
I know. Why? Because
yeah.
when you come down with every step you take, like the police said, remember that song?
I do. Yes, of course. Yes.
With every step that you take, when you're descending, you're gaining oxygen.
Right.
You're gaining energy.
Right.
You're
right.
coming down.
Right.
It's all downhill
yeah,
from here.
Yeah. Yeah. And right. it always seems to, it's interesting. I was talking to my son about it always seems to go quicker going home.
Well, sure. Because you're coming back or going down.
Yeah.
Although something to remember, a caveat. If you spend your load, if you spend all your energy at the top, and then you think that descending is just a piece of cake.
Piece of cake.
No, descending is tricky too.
Right, right.
And in some ways can be harder because a fall going down is probably more dangerous than a fall going up.
I've heard mostly, I think, from people who haven't done the summit, that it's really just a hard, long walk.
No, that is such... a mistake. In
oh, thinking. It's not Everest, you know. I mean,
it's not mountaineering. It is trekking, and still, with that, only about 40% of people summit.
Is that right? Eh? Wow, that's right. A low stat.
So your odds can be increased based on a number of factors, including training. Some people just don't train. They think, oh, I walk to work and back. That's okay. I took the stairs to the top of a building and back.
Right.
But no, you need to have more respect for what it is that you're doing. It is not mountaineering. It is trekking. But to say it's a basic hike is a mistake. It's a mistake in thinking. And that kind of arrogance can get you in some trouble.
I bet it does, yeah.
Cavalier approach to it.
Yeah.
And so there's wonderful metaphors there.
Of
How
course.
Many times do we think when it comes to a workplace project, oh, this is a piece of cake. So there's no law of the harvest. There's no strategy of I need to do A, B, and C now in order to have that later. And then they're panic stricken and trying to do it all, and glitches occur. And
so why did you decide? Was it a business move for you? Like you said, oh, you know what? This is going to make me a better speaker or a better writer.
The week
was it
before I decided to go, I didn't even know I was going.
Wow.
The week before I decided to go, it was not even part of my lifetime bucket list.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I've had
the
a few of those.
The week before I decided to go, I had not even camped in my own backyard.
That's pretty
Never mind
funny.
At, you know, 20 degrees below zero at the top
Sleeping
of...
Sleeping under the stars? What does that mean?
For 9 days.
Yeah.
I've never even camped in the middle of summer in my backyard.
So not you didn't want to just go to Lake Parry Sound first. No, I'm going to go to Kilimanjaro. Yeah.
And when you camp on Kilimanjaro, it's intense.
Yeah, I bet.
Not intense. It's intense.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
It's intense,
Funny,
too.
Both, yes.
Right? Maybe that's what the book title should be. Intense.
Yeah, yes. You can have some fun with that cover.
But it's progressively colder.
Yeah, sure.
To the point where you don't want to get naked.
Yeah.
You know, you got to change your clothes at some point.
Yeah.
And wash yourself down. There's no showers or anything.
Yeah.
But you do quick. That's not a poli-poli. That's when you do it quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I've flown over Mount Kilimanjaro on my way to Rwanda.
Well,
which was fascinating. And I took a picture of it. And I thought, wow, you poor bastards.
Well, Kilimanjaro is the tallest mountain in Africa on the African continent. It's the fourth tallest peak in the world.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it is the tallest peak in terms of freestanding mountains. Now, of course, Everest is part of a chain.
Yes.
Right? It's part of the Himalayas.
Yeah.
But Kili is the world's tallest freestanding mountain. So we're not talking a small little hill here. We're talking a big mountain, the fourth tallest peak in the world.
It's a bit of a doozy.
It's a doozy. Now, it's 19,341 feet. Meters, I can't remember, 5,800 or something. But when we flew afterwards onto Zanzibar for a few days to rest and have some relaxation, they said, good afternoon, welcome to flight, whatever it was. We're going to be flying at an altitude of 17,000 feet. Well, we all just laughed.
Yes.
Because we had climbed 2,000 feet taller than the plane was flying.
Yeah, that puts it in perspective. So as we wrap up, Nina, thank you so much again for joining me today. What's next for you? I think you talked about hopefully a new book soon.
Yes.
Is Everest next or
no.
Titanic? You know, visit the Titanic maybe?
Oh, wouldn't that be a fascinating thing to do?
I don't think
I
could do
that. I'm a little
one.
Bit scared of water.
A little claustrophobic.
I like to go for a shower and that's about it. Maybe a swim in a pool. Yeah. I don't think you'll get me going 20,000 leagues under the sea.
No, me neither.
My bucket list, I would like to do, let's see if I can do this correctly, the Camino de Santiago, you know the one.
I know the one, the way back, the way back.
Right?
Great film.
Oh, is it?
Yes,
oh,
with Martin Sheen.
I'd like to do the
directed by Emilio Estevez. You've got to see it. It was at the film festival a couple years ago.
Okay, I know it.
And the way back, I think it's on Netflix.
Do you know what it's called? The Posta
I don't.
De Santiago.
Yeah.
The Camino.
Yeah.
She was.
Oh, you would love that from what little I know of it.
But I'd love to do the Camino. It's 800K.
Yep.
And I know I could do it. I know I could do it. I just would like to do it with some friends or loved ones.
That would be great.
I don't want to do it with strangers.
Sure.
Yeah. No offense to all those lovely strangers that I haven't met.
And you would meet lots of them on the way.
I would, but it's not something that I would like to do singularly.
Yes.
I would like to share that experience.
Yeah, I think if I was
someone that I already have a history with.
Yeah.
Of course, Machu Picchu.
Yes. Right. Yes.
I have thought about Everest Base Camp.
Yeah. Okay.
But if I'm on my deathbed and that doesn't happen, I'm not going to go, damn, I didn't get to Everest Base
That's
Camp.
That's right. Yeah.
But who knows?
Yeah,
it might be.
Sure.
The oldest person on our climb, I believe, was close to 70.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I know one other person who's done Kilimanjaro. They did it at 50 and it was a real...
Well, I was 53.
Yeah, I want to do this, you know, kind of, I guess, I'm not so 50. Maybe I'm not 50 up here, upstairs, but, you know, my body might be, but I can still make it. You know, I think there was something of that kind of sentiment going on. What's the title of your new book, or do you know yet?
The title of the new book, at least the working title, who knows, at the last moment you change your mind, but the title has been all along, A Time to Creep, A Time to Soar, and then the subtitle is Lessons Learned for Work and Life from Climbing Kilimanjaro.
Oh, well, there you go.
And that's the reason why is because I came across a Helen Keller quote a few years ago, a couple of years ago, that said, one cannot be content to creep once one has soared.
Mm.
And while I appreciate that sentiment, there really is a time to creep so that if you do the creeping when you're supposed to, you go pulley, pulley, slowly, then you can have the reward of the soaring.
Right.
And one needs to know for your own best interest when to do what.
Thanks so much for joining us. It's Nina Spencer, NINASPENCER.com. We're here at the Verity Club in Toronto. What a gorgeous spot, by the way.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Thank you for inviting me. And you got to come down. I know it's by membership only, but look into it, folks. The Verity Club in Toronto. Gorgeous, wonderful gem.
For women.
Yeah, for women.
Sorry, gentlemen.
That's right. You can come as a guest, though.
But you can come as a guest and lovely meeting rooms and...
wonderful space. I'm going to end with a quote from Nina's book. Quote, life is change and work is change, but passion for your work and for your life is optional. And each one of us gets to choose. So, a few more words and then in big bold letters, class starts now. Thanks so much for joining us today and look forward to our next interview.
Oh, yes, please. And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.